Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey everyone, Jeremy Scheinwald here with the VFA Podcast. Depending on our release schedule, we're now in double digits. This should be our 10th podcast. I've really enjoyed researching the backgrounds of all of our guests, but today's guest, Gary Chow, was especially interesting to me. I want to direct you to his website, garychow.com, and that's GaryChou.com. Look through Gary's blog posts. Posts like On Self-Sufficiency or his thoughts on jury duty are challenging and fascinating reads. I didn't have a chance to read all of his posts, but I'll certainly go back and read more. Gary is the founder, or as he refers to himself, Fun Guy, at Orbital, a space to do awesome stuff. Orbital was founded with the intention of facilitating people's side projects through boot camps, product sessions, and more. Prior to Orbital, Gary was general manager at Union Square Ventures, and he simultaneously produced films and served on the faculty of the School of Visual Arts in New York City and as an advisor to the Austin Center for Design. Check out his whimsical LinkedIn profile. His titles include advisor, product manager, the man, general manager, and more. I'm eager to get to know Gary Chow. I hope you'll enjoy this episode. I've certainly been looking forward to this interview.
Welcome to Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast.
Building things can be really hard, and entrepreneurship is often portrayed in the media as the sexy or even worse, easy career path. Through this series, we plan to pull back the curtain and tell the gritty stories of entrepreneurship. We're striving to create a relaxed environment where entrepreneurs feel free to tell their stories.
This is Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast.
Gary, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I was looking through your background, and you've done an incredible, as I said in the intro, just a really vast array of different things.
It's pretty random.
That's pretty redundant, as a vast array of different things. As I look through, I feel like there's a lot of art, a lot of business, and yet, you know, you have studied computer science. You're to me, and I mean this in a complimentary way, you're all over the map. Where is the root of the interest and the fusion of art and design and business?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of weird, I guess. Like when I listen to you read all that, it feels like someone who is like very noncommittal or someone who gets distracted easily. I think that for me, a lot of it kind of goes back to just my interests. I've always been interested in kind of creative processes. A lot of my friends are musicians and filmmakers, and when I was in college, you know, I was a science major, but I was also studied a lot of photography, took a lot of photography classes. And so there was something about kind of the juxtaposition of those different disciplines in college that I think gave me an appreciation for the similarities between the two. And I think that, like, when I graduated, I didn't really quite understand that, and that was like about 20 years ago. But when you start to see these things play out over your career, you start to kind of draw these like dots together. And so, you know, that's become a big part of, I think, how I think about these things now.
And, you know, you've been chief strategist at Cisco Media and Media Solutions, and you know, I noticed you were on the briefly a roadie on the Follow Your Whim tour with your friend Go Nakamura. I hope I'm pronouncing his name right.
Absolutely.
And then there's Union Square Ventures, and there's, you know, Orbital, where you are now. Like, how do you decide which
a lot of this is just random. You know, I to your question, I don't think I made conscious decisions about anything so much as things just happened to me, right? And, you know, I look at things from a much more opportunistic lens. And, you know, every single, I'd say Orbital is probably the first thing that I've done that has been very intentional. Whereas I would say that everything else that's happened to me has been really a matter of chance. You know, like I didn't set out to be a film producer. I certainly did not set out to be a teacher. You know, all these things that you're talking about, like, they just kind of happened. They just kind of showed up. And I know that sounds like a weak answer.
Is that a model that you would suggest for others? Or did it just work out for you?
You know, actually, now that I think about it, I think it's a little bit more intricate than I'm kind of giving it credit for. I think that it's a function of like your network, right? It's a function of who you choose to spend time with, right? Like, so what you don't see on, or what's not as obvious on my LinkedIn profile, is that there's like a 3-year gap between the dot-com burst and when I got back into startups, and that was from 2001 to 2004. And I was in, you know, I was in Austin at the time working at an enterprise software company called Trilogy. And, you know, we had what we call the great layoff, where basically a third of the company just got let go. And, you know, at that point I realized, wow, you know, everything's blowing up. I think I'm going to move to California because that's where my friends are at. And also I think, you know, that's probably going to be the first place to recover, you know, in terms of tech and software and stuff like that. So I moved out to California. And my initial thought was I was going to take 2 months off and get in shape and, you know, like, go to a gym and get a trainer and then continue to explore the intersection between art and technology and stuff. But those 2 months turned into 3 years of exploration. You know, I found this Asian American community in the Bay Area, and actually not even just that, a community of Asian American artists, which was mind-blowing to me because I grew up in, like, the suburbs of Chicago, and it was predominantly not Asian. And so that got me hooked up with amazing poets, spoken word artists, filmmakers, visual artists, musicians, just people that were creating amazing things. And, you know, that drew me in, and I did a lot of wandering, and I did a lot of, like, personal exploration. And then I ran out of cash. and so I had to get a job.
Necessity is the mother of invention.
It is. And this is when 2004 came around. And then at this time, you know, I don't know if you remember this, but you remember when Friendster came out and it was mind-blowing to everybody? They're like, oh my gosh, the internet, like, we can connect with people online. This is crazy.
Right.
Right. So that was, Friendster just come out, MySpace was out. And so I joined Tribe.net, which is one of the other social networks. It just happened that two people that I'd worked with from the company in Austin had come here, and they'd been working with Mark Pincus, and they needed someone to come in and step in a product role who had been thinking about, you know, community and how you leverage the internet to build community. And they were like, hey, all these random things you've been doing are actually perfect for what we're looking for, and it just happened to be kind of the right place at the right time. You know, and if you take that random, you know, instance forward, you know, I think part of the, you know, a huge part of probably the reason why I, you know, got into Union Square Ventures was, you know, Fred Wilson had invested in, like, all of Pincus's companies, either personally or through, you know, his fund, or his funds. And, you know, I think that relationship probably helped a little bit. And, you know, so, like, all these things I kind of just characterize as just, like, stumbling forward or somewhat opportunistic wandering.
Yeah, so life's random, but you have to be ready for the randomness and ready to strike and take advantage of it and keep your eyes and options open at all times.
You do, and I think that you also have to discount how things look in retrospect, because in retrospect, every shit show that you've lived through can look like it's this amazing narrative that's been constructed. And so you listed out all these things at the beginning, which are, like, I'm like, wow, it's, you know, it's a lot of cool things have happened to me. But, you know, every single one of them, there's kind of a little bit of a messy story about how they happened and like the degree to which they were intentional. Like, you know, I didn't, like, wake up one day and say, okay, today I will produce a film. It's going to be the most amazing, glorious thing on the planet. Or, you know, like, now it's time for me to join venture capital. You know, and I'm going to, you know, that one was like a random blog post that just happened across my Twitter feed at the same time when I kind of was mentally checked out and knew that I had to leave my previous gig.
So this is taking the position at Union Square Ventures you're referencing?
Yeah. So actually, this is kind of a funny story. So I was sitting at home, like, working on something, and, you know, for work, and what comes across my Twitter feed is, like, a tweet that says, the definition of burnout is when the amount of work that you have to do exceeds your desire to do it. And I was like, wait a second, that sounds exactly like how I feel. Like, like, someone, the Twitter gods out there, like, are, like, you know, they're shining today. And then the next, like, another 20 minutes passed, or 10 minutes passed, and, like, another tweet came across, and it said, the three most addictive substances are heroin, high fructose corn syrup, and a salary. And I was just like, this is... I think this is me. Like, this is... And then another 10 minutes passed, and then someone tweeted about how they were looking, you know, Union Square Ventures is hiring for this really weird role. It wasn't the analyst position. It was this position to, like, help work with portfolio companies, and, you know, they were going to apply. And I kind of clicked through, and I was like, oh, this actually is you know, exactly the thing I would want to go do. And it was weird because it was such a weird, you know, job. There wasn't a job, you know, like that anywhere else.
Do you know who's at the root of all these aphorisms?
I think
who
that
changed your life?
I think there's only like one person on Twitter that's writing all the funny stuff, and they just publish it under like different people's names and stuff.
And this is very, very early Twitter, right?
Yeah, this is like 2009-ish. No, I think this was probably early 2010. Like springtime 2010, I think, is when they started the process.
I don't know my internet history, so I don't know when Twitter started. You know, it sort of feels like it's been here for a long time, even though it probably has a fairly short history.
But, you know, and then even the film stuff, you know, originally that started out as my friends shooting out of my apartment. And then, you know, one thing led to another, and there were some other weird things that happened that resulted in me stepping in a different role. And, you know, so, like, there's been no plan,
right?
You know, to any of this. There's been, you know, this is not part of kind of my ambition to take over the world or to demonstrate anything other than just being kind of opportunistic.
So there's so much here, and I definitely want to talk about Union Square because I think that's very it'll be fascinating to most of our listeners who know the high profile venture capital firm behind, you know, Twitter and Etsy and all sorts of other, you know, major names these days. But I'm curious about one thing you said, because you said that, you know, but the addiction to heroin, high fructose sugar, which I think is one of my addictions. The heroin is not on my addiction list.
Good. Stay up for that one.
Caffeine's probably on mine. And a salary. And so I found that interesting, considering that Orbital, where you are now, is not trying to get people to leave their jobs and is trying to get people to work on side projects. Well, tell me about Orbital to start, and then
sure,
maybe you can reflect on that. Like,
yeah,
give people just the earliest stages and keep them, you know, going with what they're doing to sustain these projects, I guess?
Yeah, so, wow, there's a lot of layers here. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, I don't think that was one question. I think it was like six, or maybe no question.
No, there are a lot there. So I'll tell you about why I started Orbital, because I think that is relevant, and I think it plays into the programs, you know, quite a bit, or at least it's consistent with that. So, you know, the gig I had at USV was great. It was foundational for everything that I do now, for all of the places where I teach, all the things I talk about. It helped kind of reframe how I look at things, and it was a really great period of self-reflection for myself, where I had to acknowledge all the things that I was really horrible at, or all the things that I was not good at where I thought I was. So it was a very important period of time. It was also a two-year gig, which was in of itself was great. So coming into the job, I knew that I had 2 years to do what I needed to do, and then I was going to go on and do my next thing. I think when I left that...
Just to maybe take a step back and describe what you were doing as general manager at Union Square Ventures.
So the firm had a thesis that, you know, there were a lot of things that were happening at portfolio companies, whether it's, you know, challenges that the founders face or the management team or even the rank and file, that where, you know, they weren't the right people to help step in and you know, be of assistance, but rather... their counterparts at different companies could. But, you know, these companies, they don't really have a whole lot in common outside of taking money from the same person, the same investor, the same firm. But could you create some, you know, could you create kind of a, you know, almost like a dinner party where people are willing to come together and trust each other and share what they're learning with each other and open up and have those discussions. But they just knew that they weren't really the right people to go do that, right? Because one, they're focused on making investments, but two, it's kind of like a little bit intimidating if, you know, Albert Wenger or Brad Burnham or Fred Wilson are like walking in and saying like, hey, let's all have a chat, you know. So they needed somebody who had, you know, experience working in startups. I think a lot of empathy for what it's like to be working on something like that. And, you know, that's where, you know, my background, I've only worked in failed companies. You know, I have a ton of empathy for for what people are going through when they kind of work in a startup. And so the challenge was, what could you do as an individual to construct kind of that space? And that can consist of, you know, virtual things, that can consist of in-person events. You know, the CEO Summit is one of the things I used to run, but I also created a whole other series of other summits. Like, we would get the data scientists together, we would get the HR folks together, we would get the community managers together. You know, all these people where there's like the one person at the company doing the job, you know, you're kind of stuck. You know, you don't want to show your warts to your boss because they hired you to do your job. You're supposed to know what you're doing. And, you know, how are you going to get the help that you need? And if you're working at a startup, fundamentally, you're doing something that, like, no one else has really done exactly in the way that you need to do it. And that's really hard. So a lot of what I focused on was trying to create scalable programs, things that weren't dependent upon me, things where you're really just, you know, being a great dinner party host, you know, and you're kind of inviting people in. And it worked out pretty well. I think the ultimate test was, you know, being able to leave and transfer stewardship of that role to somebody else. And, you know, if I had left and the network had collapsed, then I would have succeeded at building something that was fully dependent upon me. Right. Versus a network that could stand, you know, by itself.
And was this a novel concept, or was this going on in other firms at the time?
You know, I think there's always been a history of non-investment partner roles in venture firms. You know, I think, you know, Kleiner's been doing something like this for a while. Sequoia's had something for a while. You know, and then Andreessen has a different approach where they're taking more of a services model. And so they have an expert in HR or an expert in marketing or an expert in BD or something like that.
Right.
And I think a lot of that depends on the fund size, because, you know, the fund size dictates how much capital that you have to take on kind of an expense like that. But I think for USV in particular, you know, at the time they'd made investments in Twitter and Tumblr and Kickstarter and these networks. So they were big believers in networks. And so I think the intellectual exercise was, well, you know, is there the potential for a network, albeit a somewhat small one, you know, to work here? And so that was the challenge. And that was also the other reason why they made it a 2-year gig, because if it, you know, if the experiment didn't work out, then, you know, the expectation wasn't like, you know, what are you going to go do?
This is Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast. Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it. This is Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast, a show about entrepreneurs and their stories.
And after 2 years, did you feel like you were ready to go? If it had been a 3-year gig, would you have stayed?
You know, it's that's hard to say. I think that, like, you know, here's what I'll say about that. I think that that job was like the perfect timing for me, like just from a pure life perspective, for all of the obvious reasons. But I think for some non-obvious ones, like, I think by the time that I joined the company, the level of faith that I had in organizations to, you know, or companies to be like a really great place to work all the time was not at a high. and so, you know, I think I had a slightly pessimistic model of, you know, being able to kind of create the environment that you want. And I think working at the firm really restored my faith that actually you can have a highly respectful environment. You can do things the way that you want to do them if you're able to set things up and to communicate clearly, and that, you know, all of these like positive hokey things, you know, can't exist if you're willing to talk about that and have that on the table. And so, you know, it would have been great to stay, I think, in a lot of ways. But on the other hand, I think I knew coming in, and I think the partners knew as well, you know, for me at the stage where I was at, I'd worked at a bunch of companies, and I was kind of ready to go do my own thing next. And so it might have been too safe of a space in that sense, right? So it was an incredibly positive experience. And I think that in some ways, yeah, it would have been a lot of fun to stick around for more. But part of what, you know, informs Orbital, for instance, was that I kind of knew that I wasn't interested in working at another investment firm, because I had a really great experience, you know, with this one. And I also was not as interested in working at, you know, any of the startups in the portfolio or actually at anyone else's startup either. And it's, I think that's a twofold reason there. I think one is that, like, when you have the privilege to be able to see a lot of data points, you can kind of construct in your mind what the likely outcomes are of certain situations. And, you know, that to me didn't feel like enough of the right conditions for me to go in somewhere where I'd be excited, right? Like, I kind of feel like you kind of have to, you know, I had this existential kind of, you know, crises where I had to ask myself, well, like, okay, if I'm not going and getting, you know, if I'm not moving up the ladder, if I'm not going and getting a higher salary or getting a bump up in my title somewhere or getting, you know, something that makes my LinkedIn profile look better, like, what is my motivation then? Like, and it was actually kind of blowing my mind a little bit. And then I realized, well, okay, I think the thing that motivates me, one of the things I think I believe is that, you know, time is all we have, right? You take everything else away, it doesn't matter how much money you make at the end of the day. It doesn't matter, you know, all these things that you accumulate. It just, you know, you can't get your time back. And so if that is what you're optimizing for, then, you know, you kind of owe it to yourself to put yourself in a position where you really don't know what's going to happen, you know? And so that was one of the reasons that, you know, prevented me from taking kind of a conventional role somewhere else, because I'd kind of seen too much in a way.
So when you left Union Square, pardon me, did you, day one, you had no sense of what you'd be doing next?
I think the first thing I did was actually go up to VFA boot camp and do a talk.
Okay.
I think I've spent basically the first 12 months, almost 12 months, just going through this process. I did this thing where I would do talks called what I'm working on next. And I would just use those talks. Like, I would have, like, maybe one slide on what I was working on, but, like, 95% of the talk was basically just my attempt at distilling what I'd learned. Because I had a really, between 2010 and 2013, like, was a really productive, you know, chunk of time. And also, a lot of things happened in the world. And so it took me a while to try to unpack and process what my priorities were, what I was motivated by, right? Like, you really kind of have to dig down deep and figure out, like, why do you live, you know, which is really kind of a crazy question to ask.
How many entrepreneurs do you think are really asking that question?
I don't know. You know, it's hard to say. I'm sure a lot are, right? But look, it's a privileged question to be able to ask, right? I'm incredibly lucky that, you know, the one of the weirdest things for me to adjust to in working at a venture firm, which is, you know, more of a partnership rather than, you know, is that you're not buying, selling, QAing, engineering, designing, building, you know, anything, right? You're not shipping anything. You're not dealing with customers. I mean, you have LPs and you have entrepreneurs that you work with. But because you're not in that daily cadence of shipping where you're waiting on something from somebody and someone's waiting on something from you, you don't have any time to think. But if you work as an investor, your job is to think, right? Because you're investing on these much, much longer time frames. So it was an incredible luxury to work in a space where that's what we did. You know, that was the environment. We thought about things at a wider time scale. So I think for a lot of people, you know, if you've got student loans, if you've got, you know, a mortgage, if you've got family and kids, you've got, like, all these other things that are challenging, you know, your time, you don't have as much time to sit around and think about some of these questions, which might actually be a good thing, to be honest, right? Because, you know, you make progress by moving forward little bits at a time, not necessarily by charting, like, the nirvana space to be and then how am I going to get to that. Like, you can have way too much rope.
Right.
You know?
So you had three years between USV and starting Orbital?
No. I was probably about, like, 11 months.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know. What is that? Maybe when you said 2010, 2013, I got confused. But
that was the time that I spent at USV, right?
Okay,
so that was the time post working at a production oriented
right
company.
So you leave and Orbital isn't, is it not even an inkling? How does Orbital start to materialize? And it's a pretty amazing model. So I definitely want to get into that. I think we took a tangent about 10 minutes ago away from what Orbital is.
And now we're
back there, which is important because it's a pretty fascinating model.
So I had some philosophical points that I had realized after I left the firm. I think a few is that, one, I wanted to find a way to work on projects where I could do more than one. And I think the conventional way you think about that is like a studio model of some sort, but that wasn't exactly the power dynamics that of what I cared about. I think the best way was I was talking to Jerry Colonna about this. I told him that I knew directionally where I wanted to go, but I didn't really know what the vessel was going to be. And so I knew that I cared a lot about independent creators, and I cared a lot about kind of the power dynamics that exist in people building these new platforms and systems. And, you know, I'm kind of all about the little guy. And, you know, and so I had an idea of the areas that I cared about. And so what happened was I had known about Kickstarter moving to their new office in Greenpoint for a while. So I reached out to the team and I asked them, like, well, you know, if you need someone to basically just pick up the last couple of months on your lease, you know, it'd be fun because, you know, I'll take it over. It's a pretty low cost, or it's a pretty minimized cost if it's only for like a month or two. And I've been a big believer in space as a catalyst for community and really great stuff. So I just lobbed this out there, and it was like, this is close to the end of 2013. I got a phone call while I was in LA visiting family, and it was from the company. They said, hey, we're finally moving out, but there's actually, sadly, not enough time. There's no more time on our lease, so we can't do anything fun with you. You know, sorry. But if you want, we could introduce you to the landlord. And so I was like, okay, sure. And so the landlord, you know, calls me, and she immediately goes into, like, you know, oh, this is a hot lead. I'm going to qualify this person, figure out, like, who he is, what kind of business he has, like what his revenues are, like what's he going to do with the space and all of this. And I was like, whoa, wait a second. And I just tried to answer all the questions so I could like stay in the game. And the next thing I know, I've basically agreed to like a 2-year lease for the space for all 6,000 square feet of the Kickstarter office starting in like January of the next year. And I was like, okay. And it was weird, right?
Because still, just to clarify, business, no concept of what Orbital would be, or that Orbital would be. You just sign the lease, like, I've got a blank canvas, I'll figure this out.
That's pretty much.
Okay. That's interesting.
It's kind of weird.
Fascinating.
I mean, I think that everything that Orbital is today is an articulation of a lot of the ideas and things and themes that I've thought about for many, many years, right? But it wasn't, let me go draw up a plan, it shall be named Orbital, and let's go hunt around and find a space.
Right.
You know, the thing that makes the Kickstarter, the old Kickstarter space relevant here is that it's, you know, it's incredibly under market in terms of like commercial space in New York. And so, you know, because I didn't have investors, you know, because one of the things that I'm trying to do is, and I guess I didn't explain this very well earlier, is to have optionality over the things that I make. You know, I think that if you can, you know, if you can have the luxury of building something, putting it out there, seeing how it plays out, then deciding if you want it to exist in the world, then sitting down and having the conversation about what the right sustainability model for it, you know, whether it is to raise money because it's high growth, or whether it's to take out a loan, or whether it's to crowdfund it, or whether it's to open source it, or whether it's better off with a partner or another company. You know, that's the best case scenario. You know, a lot of times you have to raise money because you don't have that optionality. So that was what I've been trying to create, you know, with Orbital the space. But those were loose ideas at the time. And the first thing was, oh, I think I can get this space. Let me see if I can get it. Okay, looks like I got it. Okay, what do I do? and then everything else kind of just fell out of that process.
So what did Orbital become? I mean, it, you know, I mentioned earlier, it's a space to do awesome stuff.
We've been talking this whole time, and we have yet to get to actually that.
There's an intro at the beginning where I hint at it. What is the concept, and how is it working?
You know, I think it's working okay. It's not working great, but it's like working okay. And so here's what I mean by that. you know, I mentioned this idea of wanting a lot of optionality for the things that you make. And I think the first step of that is, well, can you find a way to sustain the space independently? You know, so some people pay a monthly membership fee to work out of Orbital. So in some ways, it operates like a co-working space, but it's not something that I really advertise or is really open. It's mostly through kind of word of mouth and kind of my personal network. But then the other main thing that we do is we run a bunch of launch programs. And so by launch program, it's this idea of come in and for some short period of time, you know, you pay tuition and we're going to help you launch a thing. And we've done two versions of that. The first thing that we started with was what we called Orbital Bootcamp, and that was a 12-week program that you know, helped people launch, you know, their side projects, and they could be educational, commercial, social, whatever you wanted. And that kind of comes to, you know, something that I'd seen observing, you know, multiple years of teaching at a design program and all the startups that I've worked at, as well as all the things that I saw working at USV, where the initial expression of an idea, whether you're building something that's a business or a startup or an art project, there are a lot of commonalities. It's a constant struggle between what you want something to be and what it could be versus, you know, your own issues in terms of your own biases into the thing that you're making. And so, you know, what I kind of believe is that, like, if anyone who's making anything, you need some lightweight framework for accountability, you need access to informed critique, and you need a community support. And so Orbital was one version of that. And it was really great, I think, for people who were kind of ideating and starting from scratch and trying to figure out how to just navigate the creative process. The latest program that we've created is what we call the Orbital 1K. And this is a 4-week program that helps you launch something that will likely make $1,000. And this is more appropriate for someone who's, you know, got kind of figured out what they want to go do, but they're more in execution mode rather than ideation. And they're able to frame what they want to do within the confines of something that can be executed within 4 weeks and also something that can generate cash. And so you may have like a grand vision of what your business is, but what we might spend the 4 weeks on is working on what your entry point is. And sometimes that takes the form of a Kickstarter project, because a Kickstarter project, is one of the easier ways in which to generate cash in a short amount of time. But it's also a great way to present what could be a mandate for an idea or a community or a thing you want to go make, and then see if that happens.
This is Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast. Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it. This is Smart People Should Build Things, the Venture for America podcast, a show about entrepreneurs and their stories.
Something I find interesting about the model that you've developed is that it's a flat fee. You know, your 12-week boot camp is $4,500. Your $1,000 challenge. I apologize. What's it called?
It's a thousand. The Orbital 1K. It's
$1,000.
You're likely going to make $1,000.
Yeah, you're going to break even. You're not taking any equity in a time when everyone is, you know, all over equity and valuations. Maybe this speaks to what you were saying before about how your time is most valuable to you. But, you know, is that selfless and magnanimous? What is the thought process behind a flat fee for this getting someone off the ground?
I think it goes back to more of a fundamental belief, I think, that I have, which is, you know, today when you think about launching an idea or expressing an idea that you have in the world, the most conventional way of referring to it is to call it a startup, right? And if you use that language, what comes along with that is an expectation that there are founders of a startup, there's equity involved, you want to, you know, get investment and stuff. And so there's so many things that are implied with that language, but which are not at all appropriate if the thing that you're making is just an art project, or if the thing that you're making is, you know, a great one-person business or selling your own artwork or something like that. Like, you know, what artist is going to walk in where I help them with their Kickstarter project and I ask them for equity for their work? It's kind of weird in a sense. And I think that for me personally, and I think for a lot of the people that helped me run this program at Orbital and the membership at Orbital, they're all excited about just the idea of people creating anything, you know, and because if you can help people through that process of creating something and they learn and they go through the motions and they understand what that feels like, then they might be ready to go and launch something even more ambitious and more ambitious and more ambitious. But if where they're starting from is this point of making something that's been defined by kind of the media cycle and their thing has to fit into that, then it feels really awkward when it doesn't. And they start to think that the problem's with them. And it's you get into all sorts of things where misplaced expectations and a misset understanding of how things should be. You know, so it's a little bit of a commentary on that. And so the thing with Orbital and being a flat fee is just that, you know, I think it'd be less interesting for us to run a program of a bunch of people building photo sharing apps than it is for some of the projects that we see. And we see like a really great array of people building all sorts of crazy stuff.
Well, tell me about some of that awesomeness. Yeah. What is some of the awesome stuff that has materialized from the boot camps and the 1K challenge?
You know, one of my favorite ones is this woman who's been an art teacher for a while, and she came into the boot camp because she's an expert at what materials go well with what other materials, like, you know, what's the best paper if you want to do watercolors and what are the best, you know, pastels to buy and stuff like that. And so she wanted to package that up into like a monthly subscription box that that, you know, kids could play with and go run with. And so we spent the 12 weeks of the boot camp actually turning her into a user researcher, where she would go and build these prototypes of these boxes and put them out into the wild and then observe how the kids would open it and how the parents interact with it and then iterate on that and come up with another version. And so, you know, she was doing kind of the same prototyping and iterative work that we talk about with respect to building digital products, but she was learning how to do that for her own thing. That's one.
I want to interrupt. And did she continue on with it after the boot camp?
Yeah, she's still working on that.
Yeah, I think you got a customer here. My daughter would love that.
You know, another project. You know, there are a couple of projects from the 1K this past group who are, artists who are creating either their first product work, or they have an existing base, but they're trying to find a lighter weight product that they can, you know, sell that's appropriate for, you know, their audience base, where they're at in their development. And so we've come up with a couple of Kickstarter projects for them. There's one woman who's working on a social issue of trying to destigmatize this idea of mental illness in people of color communities. And she had this online website where people would kind of post pictures of themselves and kind of like their own narrative, and she wants to turn that into a book. So she used the 1K to launch a Kickstarter project that's going to raise money for a photo shoot to happen, so there are higher quality images. You know, so, you know, we have all sorts of things, and I think that like part of, you know, what makes all of this fun for me is, you know, there isn't really a place, I think, where you can go and learn how to launch stuff, right? You know, we have lots of avenues where you can learn skills, where you can acquire knowledge, but the act of launching, you know, it's not something that you can really just expect people to watch a few YouTube videos and then go do. It's something that kind of has to happen kind of in a place with people.
Have there been one or two projects that you've seen people developed that you've thought were very, very promising that they chose not to pursue? Anything that nags you?
The way in which we construct the boot camp is interesting, because at the end of the 12 weeks, we ask the student to give a talk on lessons learned versus like a demo day. Because I think part of the creative process is, for me, is this belief that, you know, you might fall in love with your thing, and that's totally fine. Or your idea might completely morph into something else, and that's totally cool too. It's like a lot like surfing. And so, you know, we don't really care where the student surfs to. We just want them to have that experience of, like, being able to, like, get up on the board if they fall off, learning how to get back on, and to go on whatever wave, you know, wherever the wave takes you. And so there are a lot of, I think, you know, students who do launch things, and maybe they're not exactly what they expected, but then that's part of the process. And then we get to sit down and talk about, well, what did you learn from that? You know, and why don't you want to do that? And why do you think you're more interested in this other thing? And, you know, I think the nature of projects is, you know, we have so many things that we start, but we stop for some reason. Like, you know, we were talking about this past weekend at boot camp. Do you collect domain names?
I have a couple that have, that yes. And I wouldn't call myself a collector. I've had good thoughts and bought certain things.
How many domains do you have?
Maybe 12 or 13 at this point. Yeah. I don't know if that makes me a collector. It hasn't been intentional. I may be following your model. There's no intentionality. Every once in a while, I'm like, oh, maybe I'll do that one day,
and I think, buy it. But I think that, you know, you don't have any guilt for every single day that you're, like, leaving those domains behind or anything, right? Yeah. And I think it's the same thing with the things that you work on. So much of, you know, everything is timing, right? Like, all the things that you write about me, 100% timing. And I think it's the same thing with the things that you work on. For whatever reason, you know, maybe someone launches some new thing that introduces you to the idea that there's, like, this better thing that you should be spending your time on. You know, and that's the thing. You're like, your time is finite, and you have to guard that, and you have to be mindful of how you spend it. And you can't have this attitude that, you know, the things that you make are entitled to exist, nor that there's something that you should be doing that you're not doing. You know, so, but the problem is that if everything that we make is framed in the language of a startup, it brings along, I think, a lot of connotations that aren't as healthy for the creative process. Like, you should be free to just cut and run if the thing that you're doing is not what you should be doing.
But do you think failure possibly has been glorified too much? I don't want to point any fingers. I'm not going to mention any names, but there's a relatively high-profile firm that shut its doors and returned millions of dollars to investors and kind of said, well, you know, we'll fail faster and learn more. Something like that. You can surmise the way you can figure out which firm it is, I suppose. But, you know, I thought to myself, maybe this has gone, to me, maybe this is a tremendous, this is a leading question like never before, but I feel like it's gone too far where if something doesn't work, you just kind of say, oh, well, you know, the easiest thing to say is we failed and we've moved on and that's it. And you have to accept that answer as an investor or a partner. That's my leading question. Do you think it's gone too far? Broadly, I suppose, on a micro level, it probably hasn't, but
you know,
on a macro level.
I think that, I think what's gone too far is that there's so much rhetoric, not just even about failure, about how you should spend your time, what things are worth working on. It's, you know, what the hot thing of the, you know, what's the hot flavor of the month? There's always something. And I think it's a lot of noise, right? And I think the creative process is somewhat intentional in some ways, but I think a lot of the good things that you make are things that are they're kind of like accidental. Like my photography teacher used to talk about how, you know, most people think about art and what you make as a practice or an action of what was the phrase? This intentional, you know, imaginative invention, I think is the phrase that he used. You know, and I think that's what you think of, like when you think of a painter. Oh, they come up with some amazing image in their head, and it's this imaginative invention. And part of what he advocated for as a photographer is this idea that chance is just as powerful a creative force. But the problem is that, like, left to our own devices, we kind of screw that up because we listen to other people, or we do things for approval, or we react to kind of what's happening in the media, and that kind of almost robs us of our ability to create things in that vein. And so I'm kind of dodging your question anyway, because part of one of the reasons why I created Orbital was to not kind of pay attention to anything that's happening. And so it's been really great, because in a lot of ways, like, the voices are out of my head. Like, I'm not spending, you know, I still follow all the things, I still read everything that's happening, but because it's not part of my job to know everything that's happening anymore and stuff, there's this, it's been really kind of like, I've been having a great time. Like, it's been fun. To the specific failure point, though, I think that there are a lot of, you know, I don't know. I think I'll take the opposite position, which is that we're not over-glorifying failure if what we are doing is sharing what we're learning. But I think that, you know, sometimes the emphasis is placed on failing versus learning, right? Like, I would never launch the Orbital Fail Camp, right? With a 12-week program to fail at something, right? But I think that you do want to allow for it as part of the process. But one thing that I have learned is that, you know, with the boot camp, it's very unconstrained. And so you tend to have a wider variance of outcomes. Whereas with the 1K, it's much more tightly constrained, both in the timeline as well as the stated goal that you're going to launch something that's likely going to make you money. And that's actually been easier to shepherd people through a process where they are successful at launching. Now, whether the projects they launch, you know, successfully raise the money, we'll see. But I think we've done a decent job of coaching them through something that's actually viable for them. You know, like there's, I think I've softened a bit in, I used to be very much this idea of like, we're going to throw everyone to the fire. Then like, haha, watch them as they try to build their planes on the way up or something, right? Like in this somewhat of a sick sense. But I've really kind of come around to this idea that like you want to try to give people space to have optionality in what they do, but you want to make sure as a instructor, as a teacher, that you're helping them kind of move in a positive direction too.
So we're not going to see the orbital fail camp anytime soon. So we talked earlier about fun guy, or I believe on your LinkedIn, on your webpage, it says fun guy living in Brooklyn. What isn't fun? I mean, you clearly are a fun person. I think you deserve that moniker, but what isn't fun?
I think it's not fun filling in a LinkedIn profile.
Which is out of date.
You know, so that whole thing kind of came about because... I referred to this 3 years of wandering before, right? From 2001 to 2004. And it was really awkward because I found myself meeting people and I would introduce myself as someone who used to work at an enterprise software company doing product management. And I was like, why does this person even care like what I did in my last job? Like, and why am I so like reliant on my professional identity and title as the thing that holds my self-worth? And so, you know, when I look at something like a LinkedIn profile or a resume, I feel like that's like one of the worst ways to allow or enable people to express who they are. So I think like my act of rebellion here is just to make my title on LinkedIn fun guy, because then like I never have to update it, right? Like, can I? I don't know if I could ever get fired from that role. and so, you know, that's kind of why that's there.
I'm going to go back to the office and change my name to Fun Guy as well. You'll think it's a little curious.
I think it'd be awesome if everyone listening to this podcast went and changed their title on LinkedIn to something like Fun Gal or Fun Guy or, you know, Mushroom or whatever it is that you wanted to. That was just, you know, a declaration. But, you know, it's Here's something that's very relevant to Orbital, and I think you said something before that may not necessarily be entirely true from my perspective, which is that, you know, I think the product of, you know, living in a world of networks is that we're far more exposed to the narratives of many people outside of our own geography, right? So what we can become is no longer limited to the stories that we hear from our friends or our family. You see them play out, and there are a lot of good narratives on Twitter. There are a lot of really unfortunate narratives on Twitter. I think from a career perspective, it gives people, you know, every time you see someone launch a Kickstarter project, you're like, hey, I used to do that when I was in school. Like, this is like that, this person should be me. And there's something about, you know, that gnaws at people, right? Because, you know, on the other hand, I mean, I don't know how old you are, but, you know,
the exact same age as you. I graduated in 98. Or you...
I'm a couple of years older,
right,
than you.
Your LinkedIn says 98, but that was, you went back and studied computer science.
Yeah, so, you know, when I graduated from college, you know, and this came up at the VFA boot camp, you know, people asked, like, you know, why, you know, how did you, you know, all these things that you're doing, it's amazing, like, how did you, know, did you always feel this way? And I pulled up a timeline of my life, because I went through this exercise of actually graphing out how I'd spent every single year of my life from zero up until like, you know, I was 35 at this time, I think, or 36. And I pointed out that basically, you know, the past, it's only been within like the past 5 years that I've made sense of the previous 20. Like everything else, all of that, those 20 years had been a total shit show, right? And it's, you know, it just takes time for a lot of these things to unfold. Okay. And how I think this plays out with Orbital is that I think lots of people now are, and with the LinkedIn thing, is I think lots of people now are aware that they can have more complex narratives than simply you know, working at their job from 9 to 5 and doing stuff. And it's just that right now the vocabulary that we use to describe that is what we call a side project.
But, that's interesting.
You know, when the cost of technology to launch things, when you have networks on Twitter and Facebook to get the word out, when you have access to information on YouTube and Wikipedia and all these sorts of narratives of people who have done stuff before, the ability for an individual to do things that used to take a team, you know, like you're seeing that play out not just with cute little, you know, art boxes on Kickstarter, but to people launching companies this way. And that has profound implications on not just the economics of these businesses, but also on our culture and our society.
So last question, a guy who has figured out his life in the last couple of years and figured out patterns.
I haven't figured it out yet.
Okay, so that's the question. What's next?
You know, I think the big thing for me is I've yet to really make a lot of progress on this idea of bringing people together to collaborate on projects. And I think I've been kind of iterating on different ways in which to frame that. And, you know, that's the whole reason why I started Orbital. And so that's really the big thing that I need to move to next, outside of getting, you know, a little bit more comfortable on the financial side of kind of bringing some more money in. So
right,
you know, it's all the practical stuff, right? Runway.
Fantastic. Thanks so much. You've been an amazing guest, despite the fact that you cursed on our show. We'll forgive you for that.
Twice.
No, thanks so much. It's been really, really interesting. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.